Major Smith, Reel 3.
Now, you were in Quetta for the earthquake. How long did you stay
there? No, we weren't there for the earthquake. We went shortly afterwards, about a year afterwards, I think. And how long did we stay there? A couple of years, I think. About 18 months, 2 years, perhaps.
So what other duties did you have there besides helping the civilian authorities?
That was the main thing, apart from an odd break for training. The main concentration, the wreckage and so on and so forth was so devastating that it was quite a major task to get the place back in order and ticking over again, the services like the drainage, water, light and so on and so forth. And that took up the whole of the time. There were odd intervals in between as the situation eased, where one could then get on with training. That was mainly of the mountain warfare kind. And training under canvas in camps nearer up onto the Afghan border. But that was purely routine. There was nothing of great moment in any of that.
No, but I'd be interested if you could tell me something about the training. Presumably it was different from the kind of training you had in England.
Yes, it was indeed. It was mountain warfare, and it was devised to cope with the raiding tribesmen who get their living by interfering with the passage of people passing to and fro with the goods on the back of an animal and so on and so forth. A kind of a caravan convoy, shall we say. These people would hop down from the hills. They were mostly all armed. And they would raid a caravan convoy or other travellers, steal what was of any use, and depart. And our main task in the area was to prevent that happening as far as we were able. You couldn't obviously run out each time there was an incident because they were so wide apart. Areas are vast. Dealing in terms of hundreds of miles where ordinarily one would consider distances of 200 or 300 yards there, it was an entirely different thing altogether. So that an expedition would be mounted and go out to picket a particular area and would be out perhaps for about a week doing this. And the process of doing it, there was a set drill laid down in order to eliminate the danger to your own people, in that you had to cover the heights in an area before freedom of movement took place, and so that you would send up some scouts, perhaps a half dozen or so, to clear an area of high features which commanded a good field of fire. And when they were once in position and were able to signal through the means of heliograph that all was well, then troops would debarge from the roadway and go on up to the heights and occupy them, and the scouts then would go further forward to heights that were then visible on the top that weren't quite visible from the road. So that you went on like that, first of all securing the heights, manning and consolidating on them, searching the area thoroughly, and very rarely you found anybody. But nevertheless, they were past masters at camouflage, and they could lie down, and providing they remained still, they could be within just a few hundred yards of you, the odd tribesmen, and you wouldn't know they were there. Any slight movement, of course, gave the game away, or any, shall we say, a metal piece that they were carrying, which attracted the sun's rays, would give off a reflection, things of that kind. So anything shiny metal was always covered up with pieces of dirty rag and so on and so forth to prevent that. So you searched the area in that way. Sometimes you found something, more often than not, nothing. And to get back to safety again on the main road, one reversed the whole procedure, covering the heights whilst the troops went down, and lower and lower and lower, covering the succeeding heights as that progressed. And finally, of course, you arrived at the bottom, having covered only in terms of distance perhaps 2 or 3 miles, and it would take you 2 or 3 hours to do that. It was quite an arduous business. Going up, climbing was difficult because you must realise that the troops were carrying weapons, signal kit, and entrenching tools to dig in and so on and so forth. And a climb up was always extremely arduous.
What sort of terrain was
it? Very rocky. No vegetation of any kind. Nothing grew. No water or anything of that kind. It was just a hard, rocky soil, mainly stony, and screed and things of that kind. And to come down, one had to do it as fast as possible, because whilst you were descending, your back was towards any form of danger, so you had to get a move on and do it jolly quickly. So you ran like billy-o from one spot to another. And then you consolidated that area, turned round and faced the direction from which you came. When that was safe, the pickets came in. They took up the place that you were occupying, and you went down a little bit further. You were climbing possibly, you know, several hundreds of feet with crags and high positions in the intervening ground. But you never got to the top, because as soon as you arrived at the top, you found something in front of you, 200 or 300 yards away, even higher than what you were there. So it was a continuous process of climbing and going forward the whole of the time. Quite arduous training. Mountain warfare, it was called. And the Gurkhas, of course, the Gurkha soldiers, they just simply were past masters at this. They were a lot smaller than we were, and they could climb and run like billy-o a lot faster than we. They could seem to get about. We would take perhaps a half an hour to cover 300 or 400 yards, and they seemingly would do it in about half that time. They were a lot better at mountain warfare than what we were, mainly because it was their kind of country. The Gurkhas are mountaineers, of course. Their homeland is in the Himalayas, in the foothills of the Himalayas, and of course they're used to trudging up and down hills the whole of the time, the whole of their life. So that was the training side of it, and apart from weapon training, where one fired weapons and so on and so forth on a given range, there was no other training in the Quetta area carried out at all, except of a mountain warfare nature.
When you were doing these mountain warfare exercises, your purpose was to protect trade and caravans in the frontier area. Presumably, the tribesmen also were looking out for you, for the British soldiers, as well as for the trade caravans.
That is so. That's why you can never take a chance. You never did this thing in petty numbers. You always mounted an exercise in force. If you did this, shall we say, on a platoon strength, it was practically useless. One never knew what kind of trouble one would run into. And although at the beginning, perhaps there would be only 2 or 3 of the tribesmen ahead of you that you knew nothing at all about, when they realized it was a small force only operating in the area, they would quickly muster up extra numbers. And they would produce a force, greater in strength perhaps, or by virtue of the positions that they occupied, be able to pick you off at random. They were very, very good shots, were the tribesmen. And A clip of five rounds would probably produce, at any rate, three casualties, you see. So they'd a higher rate, really, than we. And so it was always foolish to attempt to do anything of this kind in petty numbers. And usually it would be of company strength, frequently of greater strength. Company strength being something to the order of close on 100 men.
How often did it happen that there were casualties?
Well, the fashion in which we carried it out, there were never any casualties. But had we have not been so, shall we say, meticulous in the way we these operations were mounted, there probably would have been. And one could never be sure that there wouldn't. One was never sure, of course, that there were anybody in the area. You never saw anybody, you see. You became aware of something amiss with a rifle shot. And then it was too late. They would never fire a rifle unless they could virtually guarantee to bring a man down. So it was a thorough search of an area before you went further. And, of course, the nearer you got to them, the further away they scurried. And they would crawl on their bellies, of course, and get down into cover and then run like billio to a next high feature and just simply watch you coming gradually over the top on a silhouette on the skyline. And if you hadn't got these featured covers sufficiently far enough to prevent or to be out of range of, shall we say, rifle fire, you were just asking for trouble. And the rules of mountain warfare were so strict that any slight deviation would quite likely lead to a packet of trouble. So you never took a chance. And because of that, we never had any casualties. But there were casualties, of course. In,
it seems that what you were really doing was pushing the tribesmen out of the way temporarily, and presumably when you were in another area, then they went back to your former area.
That's it.
Would there have been any more effective way of actually getting rid of them or dealing with them for good?
Only by the deployment of hundreds of thousands of troops, because the terrain was miles and miles and miles. And if you can visualise trying to cover, shall we say, an area like Clapham Common, to cover it effectively, you've got to use hundreds of men. Clapham Common, of course, is nice and flat, and you can see from one side to the other. Nevertheless, you've got to use hundreds of men. So that if you multiply that from a difficulty point of view and put in mountains and so on and so forth, the force to cover it adequately would run into thousands. We'd, in later years in East Africa, we ran across that self-same thing. We would clear an area of Mau Mau dissidents, and as soon as you moved out, they moved back in. So that to prevent them doing that, you really had to man it virtually shoulder to shoulder from beginning to end. And you just never had that manpower available to do such things.
Another alternative would have been to say, well, forget about them. Let them interfere. And would have kept hundreds and thousands of troops out of the area, and they could have been occupied elsewhere. Would there have been any point in doing that?
Only from a prestige point of view. One doesn't like to know that somebody is in an area better than you. Your job really is to safeguard and police it adequately, and it's not very it's rather irksome to begin to realize that somebody is just waiting round the corner for you to turn your back, and then they pop in as soon as you depart. And so you try to strike the happy medium. You put up all sorts of bogus exercises and decoys and that sort of thing, you see, too. In other words, you play games and hope that your gamesmanship is going to be a lot better than the chap who you're opposed to.
While you were there, did you know who these tribesmen were?
They're
the nationalities?
They're Afridis. AFRIDA in the main, and they live in the foothills in little enclaves of say a dozen or so with a few mud huts, and distant from their nearest neighbour perhaps several miles. They have an uncanny system of communication. How they do it, there are no telephones or radios or things of that kind. So how they pass information from the one little group of hutments to the next, some several miles away, was always a puzzling feature, but nevertheless they did. One wonders, you know, perhaps if in the old cowboy and Indian days in America where smoke signals were used, whether they didn't have something very similar to that. They probably did. They no doubt had a system of signalling by use of the sun with pieces of shiny bright metal or glass, a piece of looking glass, for example, held at a correct angle to pick up the rays of the sun, can throw a beam, many, many miles. We did, in fact, have an exercise on one occasion with heliograph, although there was radio in its infant form in those days. I'm talking about long before the war, of course. It hadn't reached the state of perfection that it has now. Our mode of signalling was by heliograph, you see. That was with a flash lamp, and it was mounted up on a high feature, and anybody on a high feature onto which the thing was aligned could easily pick up a message. And the greatest distance we knew of that we were able to communicate like that whilst we were in the Himalaya area was a distance of 80 miles, which was quite a feat with flash lamp. But it's done with the aid of the sun, of course, mainly, and the lining up of the helio from point A to point B. If it's lined up accurately, of course, the chap looking directly down that line can pick up a flash so easy. But if it's slightly off alignment, then you probably get nothing at all. But 80 miles was quite a lot. And so that, therefore, with a little bit of shiny looking glass, these Afridis could probably get in touch with each other, and their systems of many flashes or just one flash would indicate that something was on, and could we have help, or would you like to come and have a look at this? Or that they no doubt had their own systems, because it was uncanny how they were able to suddenly, out of the blue, produce a group of perhaps a dozen or so men, each armed with a rifle, and each a power to be considered. So training in the Quetta days was based mainly on that kind of operation being mounted.
Was there any thought that after you had, by some means, removed them temporarily from an area, you could cut off their water supply, burn their village, something like that, to keep them from coming back?
That was just not on. You would be aware that there was a little group in a few mud huts that they'd erected, sticks and stones, temporary, nothing permanent, and you would go and look-see what was on there, and all you would find would be two or three women and half a dozen or so children, no men at all. And question and answer, of course, they didn't understand English. We didn't understand them. You could have interpreters with them, and the interpreters wouldn't know what they were talking about, and the villagers acting dumb. So you just got nowhere. And if you burnt that down, it was so easy to re-erect it a half mile down the road, because all they did was gathered sticks and stones, built up a cairn, you see, and put some tree branches over the top, and then all sorts of material like matting or dried grass and so on and so forth. So burning down a village didn't do anything at all. There was no point, of course, in trying to arrest the women and children. You were there. You were just you weren't going to get anywhere. So You merely made certain that there were no men in the area, but the fact that there was a little group there told you that somewhere there would be. But you could search it very, very thoroughly, and very rarely did you find anybody at all. And then if you did, he was a goat herd. All he had was a skin water bag and a crooked stick. And what could you say to him? You couldn't say that with any certainty that he'd been up to the nonsense of shooting people or raiding or robbing anybody at all, because he was so harmless and so leading such a simple way of life with just a few goats and so on and so forth. So there it was. But the whole thing was futile, really. And to police it adequately, one needed thousands of men. So you just simply cleared up an area, satisfied the locals that you really were doing something anyhow, and then waited for the next bus stop.
Did you ever capture any of them?
No. No, they were far too astute. No.
Did this training have any point in the larger view, preparing the British Army for mountain warfare in some more important part of the world?
Oh yes, that was the intention behind the whole of it. There were mountain batteries of artillery, people that went to war with their guns dismantled and strapped up onto a mule's back. A mule, a very hardy animal, could climb, of course, and so on and so forth. So the mountain batteries of artillery were always trained for that purpose, not to deal with just a handful of thieving tribesmen, but for anything that was likely to, erupt. In days gone by, that's what happened so many, many times. There was punitive expeditions organised to go and move into the varying states and to bring them to heel. They would be rebellious and so on and so forth. An entire state led by the Rajah of somebody or other. So that the whole of the training was based on being able to combat anything of that kind that did erupt. And the local tribesmen raids, of course, was just chicken feed thrown in the meantime, completely unorganised.
Did you, at the time, have any feeling of preparing for the Second World War?
No, I don't think so. We became aware of that possibly from about late 37, early part of 38, when the situation political in Europe was beginning to erupt. We knew all about Hitler, of course, from 1934 with his Reichstag fire and things of that kind. We knew that was boiling up nicely in Europe itself, but as to becoming involved in another conflagration very similar to the First World War, we as troops weren't really aware of anything likely to erupt, perhaps until the tail end of 1937, early part of 1938.
And how much did you know about the potential involvement of Japan?
Hardly anything at all. Japan in the First World War was on our side, and I think there was a feeling abroad that maybe that would be the same again, should it happen. But the Pearl Harbor nonsense with the Americans, of course, just simply shook the world to its foundations, including us. And then we realised we had to have a second think on the Japanese. But prior to that, I don't think we were very concerned at all about the Far East as such, from that point of view.
Because, of course, training in India could have been a preparation for fighting in Asia against Japan.
Yes, yes. Had we have,
this was too early for
him. Had we have had any inkling, of course, of that, and it's all right with hindsight, things like the nonsense at Singapore would never have happened had we been aware that anything it was likely to boil up further east than what we ourselves were already then. Well, as I say, Singapore just simply would have been organised entirely differently.
What did you and the other men, the other troops, think of these training operations? Was it a welcome change from sitting about, or was it something that you would really rather not do and you absolutely dreaded the thought of going out in these ghastly mountains?
Well, the training in the army is organised such that it happens every year. There are training periods starting from early June, which last throughout the rest of the year, and then one has a break at Christmas time and so on and so forth. And that happens every year, be you in Timbuktu or in Hyde Park. Odd that I should mention Hyde Park, of course. The only people that principle doesn't apply to, of course, are the guards people. They're just ceremonial the whole of the time. But ordinarily in the army, regardless of corps or what arm one is in, infantry or artillery, signals or ordnance, this training goes on every year. So that the fact that training is in India, one knows that it's going on also on Salisbury Plain or at Aldershot at home here in England.
Yes, of course, you knew it was going to happen, but that wouldn't necessarily prevent you from having an opinion about it.
No. Training from Indian point of view was always based on the problems likely to arise in mountain warfare. For example, one year it may concentrate on supplies, the supply angle of maintaining a force in action from a supply point of view only. Another may be the transportation part, although that was to a large extent eased and only effective of the movement of weapons. There were no aeroplanes used. There was no mechanical transport. If a soldier had to go from A to B, regardless of the distance between A to B, 30, 40, 50, 120, 150 miles, he did it on his two flat feet. No vehicles at all. In fact, there was no mechanisation in India until the summer before the war broke out, the summer of 1939. And then we, as a regular battalion, received our first mechanical vehicles. And the very first one we got was a 3-ton gate change Albion, and we were told that we would have to train about 50 men to drive. The establishment of vehicles for a battalion at home in those days was about 50. So that we had no drivers at all, nobody, of course, with any mechanical aptitude. And any of us that did have, at any time, own a car or anything like that, were called upon to help to train drivers. And so that the training, to go back to what I earlier said, had to be on one's flat feet. You marched, and the only thing you had to move your heavy stuff was pack animals. Artillery was designed so that it would strip down and could be loaded piece by piece on an animal's back.